Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Okay, hi. Hello, welcome back. It's a podcast. It's Sophomore Lit. And
are you sure?
And as is the tradition, Thanksgiving has come around again, and it's time for chatting about old books we read in high school with family. And so it's me, John McCoy, and with me this time is
Rob McCoy, first time foray into this new technology.
Yeah, and
Dan McCoy. Damn. I was here last year.
So we're all here, and as is the tradition, I chose an inscrutable poem for us to read. This time it's Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which was first published in 1798. But we read the edition of 1817, which adds the glosses, which explain everything.
Make it scrutable.
Yeah. Now, this was taught in Miss Garber's class. Was it Miss Garber?
It could have been. I don't remember anything.
At all?
At all.
Ever?
I blocked out Eureka High School, pretty much.
I have no idea. I have no idea who you're talking about.
Okay.
Because I must have known her by a different name.
Okay, so anyway, we had a class in high school, and it was, I remember that this was taught in a big textbook called Adventures in Literature or something like that. No, Adventures in Reading, and it had a picture of a horse jumping over a dressage fence, so that was exciting.
John apparently remembers everything, as opposed to Rob's nothing.
Well, I remember about Manistique Lakes, but...
Oh, come on, that's a different podcast. So, anyway, Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge was published in 1798 in Lyrical Ballads, along with William Wordsworth. Now, this is considered the start of Romantic poetry, the start of modern poetry, and so for those reasons, high schoolers all around America have to read either this poem or Kubla Khan or something by Wordsworth like I wandered lonely as a cloud. Now, do either of you remember this, or was this completely? Did I blindside you with this?
I kind of remember it. I know I've read it.
I remembered a guy shooting an albatross. I remembered that albatross being hung around his neck, and then I remembered later on him coming to some sort of spirit area.
There are a lot of spirits here.
Yeah.
Okay, so the poem, as we mentioned, this is a poem about an ancient mariner, and he
waylays a man.
Yes,
he stoppeth one of three.
He accosts a guy on his way to a wedding feast or wedding, I don't know, wedding banquet, maybe just the wedding.
I have to say, I like the first line of this poem because it sounds like you asked the question, what is it? And like Coleridge starts in the middle. It is an ancient mariner.
Yeah. Yes, no, it answers the question no one asked. But so the ancient mariner pulls this guy aside who wants none of him, but he ends up telling him his intriguing tale of bird murder and being and everyone on the ship dying and people being accosted by spirits. So Robert, you summarize this poem.
Summarize it. They go down to the South Pole. They get stuck in ice. The bird helps them out of the ice, but then there's mist, and then they think that the bird's at fault, and the mariner kills the albatross. And things go well for a little bit, like one stanza, and then everyone's in the tropics again and dying of thirst, and then death and life show up in a skeleton ship, and everyone dies except the ancient mariner, because apparently death and life wins the dice game. And then
which is like talk about things that would be inscrutable without the gloss. Like I had no idea there was a dice game when I read it the first time, and then I went back and I looked at the other thing, and it just there's like one line that mentions them tossing dice and Death and Life being like I won.
And then the mariner suffers for a while till he sees the sea snakes, which has spiritual epiphany that the sea snakes are beautiful, and the albatross, which had been hung around his neck, drops into the ocean.
He didn't think to just take off the albatross once everyone else died.
Yeah. No one was making him keep that albatross.
And off. Some spirits, which Goss tells us are not either angels or devils, but some sort of in-between spirits, help the mariner get towards land. Hermit and Pilot save him. Mariner has the... At the boat sinks, though. Mariner has the another epiphany that he who loveth Beth prayeth best. I cannot speak. And...
Well, he who loveth Beth. That's
the who doesn't love Beth? I sure love Beth.
Beth is the bride.
Sure.
Anyway, Mariner tells our wedding guest his story. That's a very quick and inaccurate summary.
Right. No, that was a much better summary than I could give, and maybe better than I imagined was possible for a very weird poem.
Now, this poem is written in a kind of a very sing-songy rhyme, and mostly in quartets, sometimes in quintets, and is full of language that was arcane even at the time it was published. So, of course, it became the most popular poem out of lyrical ballads.
That was one thing that really bothered me about this poem is how sing-songy the rhyme is, but then it would change format. So you would be moving along on a certain rhythm, and then all of a sudden, yeah, there would be five lines to a stanza instead of four, and it would be a different meter. And
well, who uses the word shrieve when they mean shrive?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
There's a bunch of great words in here. There's the word eftsoons.
I do like that one.
Which means what? Soon afterwards or something like that?
Well, okay, soon. Also, he uses the word swound twice, and including in my favorite, and by favorite, I think I mean the worst part of the poem, where Coleridge writes, "The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled and roared and howled like noises in a swound." I don't know what a swound is, but up over and above the ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. Also, it cracked and growled and rolled and howled like noises. Those are noises. It doesn't have to be a simile.
Right. Well, so apparently Wordsworth was not fond of this poem. He kind of badmouthed it, although he claimed later both to have given Coleridge the idea for the poem, and then he also complained about the poem, like saying it had no place in the book. So he was playing it both ways. So let's talk about this crazy mixed up journey. Now, there is given absolutely no justification for why the mariner shoots the albatross. I just want to point that out first. Mm-hmm. You know, they are at this point in the story, for some reason they've made it down to Antarctica, I guess, which seems like they are not very good sailors. And the albatross is just kind of hanging around the boat, and the mariner shoots him. Now, these days, I think it's from this poem that we get the phrase. People think of an albatross to bear as a sign of public shame, but I don't. I also think it's from this poem that we get the idea that albatrosses are even a sign of good luck. I don't know if it predates this thing.
Pre-existing superstition.
I did like 5 seconds of research, and there was some support for the idea that they're good luck, but there are also some support that sailors routinely shot and cooked them. the crew of Captain Cook's ship shot and cooked albatross, but they also, you know, ended up killed on the Sandwich Islands, now known as Hawaii. So maybe they are bad luck to kill.
Well, right.
That's more facts than I'll be able to bring to anything.
Listeners, take heed. The other thing I want to point out here is once things start going really bad for the sailors and death and life and death show up, it struck me like you know how in 99 Red Balloons when Nina like starts World War III,
yep.
And it turns out that Nina is the only one who gets to survive, and that's not fair. And I feel it's the same way about this Mariner. He's the guy who shot the albatross. He's the only one who gets to survive. I don't think that's fair.
But the albatross wants to teach him a lesson rather than.
I think life and death is worst, I think, is the lesson. But he also repents some by, once again, seeing the beauty in the sea snakes.
Right. The thing that you did leave out was that after this epiphany about the beauty of all of life's creatures, the all the dead sailors, who at this point are pretty ripe, it's been like three or four days, are inhabited.
It's been 7 days, we've been told.
Oh, 7 days. Yeah, they become inhabited by these spirits they get up and they start running the ship again.
The upper air burst into life, and 100 fire flags sheen. To and fro they were hurried about, and to and fro and in and out the wan stars danced between. And the coming wind did roar more loud, and the sails did sigh like sedge, and the rain poured down from one black cloud, the moon was at its edge. The thick black cloud was cleft, and still the moon was at its side. Like waters shot from some high crag, the lightning fell with never a jag, a river steep and wide. The loud wind never reached the ship, yet now the ship moved on. Beneath the lightning and the moon, the dead men gave a groan. They groaned, they stirred, they all uprose, nor spake nor moved their eyes. It had been strange, even in a dream, to have seen those dead men rise. The helmsman steered, the ship moved on, yet never a breeze up blew. The mariners all gan work the ropes where they were wont to do. They raised their limbs like lifeless tools. We were a ghastly crew. The body of my brother's son stood by me, knee to knee. The body and I pulled at one rope, but he said not to me.
And they're not the ghosts of the sailors, we're told. They're a bunch of, like, seraphim or something.
Angelic spirits here. Yeah. These are the good spirits here.
Right. Now, that doesn't
seem... I left it out because it's so ordinary and otherwise crazy. Poem.
Now, this doesn't seem like a very well thought out plan by the angels or whatever. I it just doesn't seem, you know, if you really want to impress your message of universal love for all creatures, I'm not sure that a zombie army of sailors is the best way of doing it. I mean, we're told there's like 200 sailors who die on this ship.
Yes. 4 times 50.
But, I mean, it's the zombie sailors that sail him back home, though, right? That's, I feel like...
It's unclear. I mean, this is not a very scrutable poem, and it is, but there's something about either the zombie spirits are helping, yes, but there's also some blowing force, but there's also the polar force. There seems to be the malevolent force that is the mad that the albatross was killed in the first place. So there's a lot of spirits here, and it's hard to sort them all out.
Yeah, there's when they get sailed away from the becalmed waters, there are these two spirit voices that are talking to each other about whether or not the Mariner has suffered enough and whether he will go on suffering. And it's not really clear who they are. We're told in the gloss that the boat is being chased by this spirit. It says here, a spirit had followed them, one of the invisible inhabitants of this planet. Neither departed souls nor angels, concerning whom the learned Jew, Josephus, and the Platonic Constantinopolitan, Michael Psellus, may be consulted. They are numerous, and there is no climate or element without one or more.
Yeah. So, Cole is just explaining to us that there's just ghosts all around, is basically what he's saying.
Yeah, well...
There are also slimy things with legs that walk on the sea.
Mm. Yeah.
So, interesting world.
Yeah. So, all's well, because in the end, the Mariner now has a life where he gets to go from town to town telling his story.
Right. And I don't know whether it was the first use of this phrase or not. I don't know which things were coined by this poem and which things may have pre-existed. But at the end, the guest, after learning from the Ancient Mariner, says, "And is he went like one that hath been stunned, and is of sense forlorn. A sadder and a wiser man, he rose the morrow morn." And I find that funny, because I read that and I'm like, really? He's wiser now? Then he gleaned more from this story than I possibly could, because I'm not really sure what lesson is to be learned, other than, I guess, don't shoot an albatross.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know whether sadder but wiser came from this poem
or
not.
I think that came from this, this is also where water in the air and not a drop to drink comes from this poem. So it is an influential poem. I don't know that it makes a lot of sense. The other poem that everyone reads by Coleridge is Kubla Khan, which makes even less sense. And in a way, you know, it is. You can see why it's important, because what was popular before this? What was popular right before this? Were people like Pope was popular, and Dryden and John Donne. Well, John Donne was like 200 years before this. And so there were poems that were being written sort of like novels, and this is something, you know, as strange as it is, you could actually read this aloud. So this is a poem that is returning to a lyrical form, like trying to be read aloud, as opposed to nobody can read Paradise Lost, you know, aloud for any length of time. And it is a poem that celebrates the imagination. So it's just like a really, really weird imagination.
Yeah. No, it does seem like it kind of reminds me of if someone had a heavy meal and then dreamed a Tales from the Crypt episode, then this might come out.
Yeah, now, can you imagine if the Crypt Keeper were like a real, like had joined Greenpeace or something? So what have we learned?
I'm not sure. Sea is very scary. Yeah. I gotta say, I like the poem, though, even though it's crazy, because it was crazy. It was very vivid in the imagery, and you know, you just didn't know what's gonna happen next. And then it had this crazy love environmental message tacked on to horrible death and zombies and slimy creatures. And then, you know, what's not to love?
Yeah, I suppose so. I'm sort of imagining a dramatic, like a TV version of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. I'd like to see a TV movie of this.
I think that there was a silent movie made of this.
Oh, really?
But I know nothing more than that one was made. So it may be. I'll bet it's on YouTube. So after we're done with this, we'll go and watch that or not.
The traditional Thanksgiving viewing of the silent film made of Prime and the Ancient Mariner.
Well, I hope wherever you are, you're enjoying Thanksgiving with your family. And if you are finding it difficult to discuss this year's elections or last year's election, go off and read Rime of the Ancient Mariner in the room you spent high school in.
Yeah. Okay. Good advice.
Okay, well, I'll see you next time.
Thanks to my brothers, Rob and Dan, for doing this silly thing. Thanks to David Lore, who did the reading and mixed the sound effects. Sorry, David, that this wasn't a more serious episode. You can hear David's work on the Incomparable Radio Theater. By the way, I mentioned in the podcast that there was a 1925 silent film made of Rime of the Ancient Mariner and suggested that we look it up on YouTube. Well, it turns out that this is a lost movie, and it sounds pretty crazy. I wish it were still in existence. It starred Clara Bow as the romantic lead, and if you're wondering how you could put a romantic lead into the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, I wonder that too. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I hope you're enjoying your break from school, but remember when you get back, everything will be on the final.